Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I hereby welcome all of you to harvest season, which has absolutely nothing to do with today's program.
No, but no, I guess it doesn't, because we've got some gadgets. we love gadgets, and we have some superb gadgets for you today.
And I don't know about gadgets. I call it equipment.
I call them gadgets, but maybe they are kitchen equipment. I don't know. They're kitchen gadgets. How about that?
And then at the
end of the program, we have just one of a delightful couple talking to us about their rediscovery, I guess, and their redefinition of kosher.
It's not all kosher.
What do you call it?
It's not much kosher.
What do you call it?
Modern Jewish cooking.
Okay. Well, I always get it wrong. But anyway, we'll get back to that towards the end of the program. But starting out, first up, we have.
This is why I say it's not just we're not talking gadgets. We're talking about a brilliant way to bring the things that you imagine and conceive of to market.
I wish that I had
that opportunity over the years when I had these brilliant ideas.
So it's a system, if you like. It's a community.
But
at the end of it, after they've all gone talking to one another, they actually produce some really useful things too.
We're talking to Baron Nagy or Nagy. Which one is it, Baron?
It's Nagy. I think would work.
Nagy. Okay, and you're also. You also have another name, but we're not going to go into that. I'm interested in the company that you're spokesperson for here, which is one of my favorite words. It's called quirky. I love it. I use it all the time. I'm not altogether sure what quirky is, how it got started, and how the whole process of design works. But the central concept is designing and bringing to market, right?
Yep. So, you know, the intention behind Quirky is to offer everyday inventors a way to effectively get their products to market. Our founder, Ben Kaufman, was an inventor himself. He developed accessories for Apple products, and one day he realized, why does it have to be expensive and so time-consuming for an independent inventor to develop their product and bring it to market? And so he wanted to create a place where people share their ideas and potentially get them into a physical product that they can hold in their hand and earn royalties for. And so that's essentially what Quirky is. It's social product development. It's a way that people can share their ideas with a community of like-minded people and can collaborate with that community and with our staff to bring those products to market and make them something real and tangible that they can share with their friends.
Baron, do you want to take an example of a product and talk about how that concept worked in the case of this particular thing that somebody invented and then you perfected?
Absolutely. So one great example is one of our barbecue products, Steak, which is a 3-in-1 grilling tool. It was invented by a toy designer from California named Peter Wachtel. Like many quirky products, the idea came to him when he was living his everyday life. He was grilling with his family using three different barbecue tools, and he thought, well, isn't there a way for me to combine these into one tool? And so he found out about Quirky, and he decided to submit his idea, and it was originally, it was called the Fong, I believe that Tong fork spatula. It was a combination of tong and a fork and a spatula. And then we loved the idea. We picked it for development. Our community, they can vote and give feedback on ideas that are submitted, and it got a lot of great feedback, and a lot of people really wanted to see it come to market. So we picked it, and then so we pick an idea. We run it through a collaborative development process with our community, and so put this idea out to the community. And
now said, what is this community?
Well, the community is it's a body of users on Quirky. We have 250,000 users on the site right now, everyone from engineers and industrial designers to homemakers and stay-at-home moms and just everyday folk who want to contribute to this process. And so on top of submitting invention ideas on Quirky, you can participate and help other people develop their ideas into a finished product.
How do you get on that, into that community?
It's very easy. It's completely free to participate. All you need to do is go to quirky.com and sign up for an account. And once you sign up for an account, you can fully interact with the site, voting on ideas. You can contribute to the design of an idea. You can submit ideas for names and taglines for products. You can fill out a market research survey. And all of these actions can give you the potential to earn a royalty percentage in that final product.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah, so, you know, essentially the idea is that anyone who tangibly contributes to a product should be getting a royalty percentage. So, you know, every product pays out royalties to anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 users in the site, depending upon, you know, how many participated in that process.
Now, do you actually make these things? I mean, once the design's complete, how do you produce in the quantity that the market demands?
Well, you know, once we finish designing a product, we put it on our site in something called the upcoming section, where people can provide their input on pricing, you know, what they think would be too high a price, what would be too low, what would be a good bargain. And we use that data to generate optimal price point that we can with manufacturers. And we have a group of partner manufacturers, many of whom are now in China, but we also have some partner manufacturers in the United States producing our products, and we're going to try to more and more towards U.S. manufacturing as we're able. And so we do work with a group of these partner manufacturers who will make our product that we can then distribute to different retailers and on our online shop.
Do you market as well then?
Yeah, we do. We have a retail team that will pitch products to different retail partners. You know, we sell our products through Target, Amazon.com, Bed Bath & Beyond, the Container Store, and many other retail partners, and also smaller businesses around the country and around the world. And our marketing is actually pretty grassroots. You know, we do have a lot of exposure through those brick-and-mortar stores and through, you know, media outlets as well. And so, you know, we generally let our, you know, the story of our inventors and our products speak for us.
Yeah, no, I saw that there are two, the inventors are listed on the package of the two items that we got. Unfortunately, we didn't get that steak because that was the one I wanted to see if it worked. But we had the, what do you call it, the double pronged thing?
Oh, the
skewers. The skewers, yeah, the sliders. Skewers, yeah.
That's brilliant. That one in and, I mean, I always found that difficult getting those cubes of meat off of the skewers. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, and exactly. And much like steak, you know, Tim Hayes, the inventor of sliders, had that same thought. He was trying to get off a kebab, and he said, well, you know, there's got to be an easier way to do this. So he had the idea for sliders and submitted it to Quirky, and you know, thanks to some community members who gave some key input in the design, it turned into what it is now, and we're really proud of what he was able to come up with.
Now, you have a really elaborate thing, which is sort of for fetching and carrying to the grill.
The porter.
Yes, porter. Porter is interesting. You know, it's intended to be only grilling container that you need. And so there's a bottom container that allows you to store any food that you have, and then a modular top containers, which allow you to store any food that you've marinated or raw food that you're going to put on the grill. And then also a caged condiment caddy that attaches that put condiments and, you know, paper towels on. So you have this all-in-one modular kit. You can carry everything out to the grill at once and then carry things back as you need it. And so have to worry about bringing all, you know, different types of containers and carrying things in batches. You just bring, you know, everything in one concise kit.
Now, the quirky product that gets me the most attention, because I'm an almost daily shopper at the Whole Foods up the street, is what you call the Mercado.
Which means market.
Which you need to take going to the supermarket 102, not 101, to know how to use the Mercado. It seems to puzzle some of the checkers at Whole Foods. Other ones of them can figure it out right away. So explain this one, because it's sort of like Joseph's coat of many colors, except it's a bag with many pockets.
Yeah, it was actually submitted as part of a brief. Generally, ideas will be coming in from community members consistently, but sometimes we'll put out a special project or a call to action, you know, inviting people to submit ideas in a certain category. So this was a grocery shopping brief, a summer brief for produce. And Mercado was actually invented by Peter Wachtel as well. We have, you know, several inventors on the site who have made multiple products, and this is Peter's second product. You know, he designed it to be a bag that would allow you to effectively carry any type of produce. And so there are mesh pockets for different fruits and round vegetables and bulbs, and then also straps to hold longer stemmed produce like leeks. And so essentially, you know, when you're going through a farmer's market or any grocery, you'll know exactly where to put each type of produce so that it's going to be safe and secure in the bag.
Now, how many people make the decision about which of these ideas to pick?
Well, it's interesting because that is also one of the communal processes on the site. When an idea is first submitted, we have the users on the site who are voting on the ideas. They're giving their comments and feedback, either saying, hey, I would love this product, or saying, oh, you know, this is great, but perhaps you could change this. And this is happening through the evaluation process. And then the Quirky staff look through all of these ideas. You know, we judge the feedback, we judge the potential of the concept, and then we'll pick ideas that we think have potential to be under consideration. And these go through a staff evaluation process that culminates in our live product evaluation meeting. These happen every Thursday at 7 p.m. Straight on the Quirky site. We essentially get together as a staff, and we meet in the office to discuss 10 of the best ideas that have been marked under consideration that week. You know, we talk about the pros and cons, and we hold a final vote. And community members can actually watch this live broadcast on our site, and they can share input in a chat that I'll actually be sitting up at the front of that discussion reading out community members' comments. They have tools where they can share their input on pricing and share their overall sentiments on the product as the discussion is going. So the ultimate decision really is made by a huge group of people, the whole Quirky staff and any community members in the chat. So we work under the philosophy that the more heads you can put together on a project, the better the outcome.
You know, I'm just going to say I really wished you existed because I've had some ideas for around.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You should have met Anne 30 years ago. She had more crazy ideas.
Yeah, but I was never able to see. I didn't know what the next step was, and I had a patent attorney, and he just made things more complicated. And then eventually these ideas started showing up as finished products in some of these, you know, these home trends and those catalogs.
But Anne had, at the time, I had no way to get there. Because you didn't exist.
Yeah, this idea.
It's really shocking, you know, how many people have ideas but you know, have no real means of getting them to market. You know, I've talked to people who, in that same situation, or there's an everyday Joe with a good idea. I know they talk to lawyers and invention help sites, and people spend anywhere from $10,000 to $150,000 just trying to see if their product can make it to market and seeing no return on that. So with Quirky, the intention was to give people a place to submit the idea. You submit an idea for $10 on the site, and that's mostly just to make sure that people are invested in their ideas,
right,
and they're not submitting something frivolous. But it's the only thing that we ever ask anyone to pay. So you would submit an idea for $10, and if it gets selected, and that's fantastic, we'll work with you to develop the fully finished product. And if it's unfortunately turned down, you still get this great feedback from the community who voted and commented,
right,
and then you don't have to pay that $5,000 just to see if your product has a chance.
And where do you get your money, Quirky?
We make our money from product sales. Essentially, the whole community, that being users and staff, everyone is in the same boat because we all make money from the same thing, which is selling products. So we want to make sure that we're all on the same team, and that the goals that we're working towards are the same ones as the community. Because ultimately, with product development, any relationship is built on trust, and that's why we prioritize transparency, and we make sure that we're only making money if the inventor is making money.
Take a standard percentage, or does it vary?
Well, it varies. Generally, because Quirky handles the entire development process, the revenue is coming into Quirky, and then we pay out that revenue to community members. Essentially, when we sell a product indirectly, which is through an outside retailer, 10% of any money coming to Quirky, it will be going to the community members who contributed to that idea. And when we sell a product directly through our site, 30% of the revenue is going to the community members. So, each product sells in different quantities on the site and in outside retailers, but all that money goes into one pot that then gets distributed to community members based on their percentage of that royalty.
And tell me this, who holds the patent?
Well, the patent or the intellectual property, if the patent has been applied for, is held by Quirky. And when we select the idea for development, when the idea is submitted, the inventor has full control over the idea. They can take it off the site, they can pursue it elsewhere at the same time. And, the only time that we'd have the right to work on the product is if we selected it and then they consented to work with Quirky, because we acknowledge there are other ways to develop products and we want people to be pursuing all the options. But once we start development, because we're taking on the full cost and the risk, we do have to ask for the intellectual property to be passed to us. But of course, the relationship with the inventor is ongoing. A team of folks called Invention Ambassadors, who are essentially account managers for the inventors. Yeah, it's a pretty creative title for a pretty creative position. They do everything from past production updates to inventors, to chat with them about their upcoming ideas, give them feedback from the design team and pass the inventor's feedback to the design team. So you can really have a very close personal relationship with Quirky, even if you're working remotely, because we have inventors from all around the world, and not just in the U.S.
Now, do you have a name for the kind of organization that you are? I mean, you're sort of like 21st century social media becomes something.
very interesting. A lot of people will call Quirky a crowdsourcing site, crowdsourcing being a means of harnessing a large group of people to perform a task. But Ben, our CEO, doesn't like grouping Quirky into that sector because it's more than crowdsourcing. We're not just using the community as a resource. We're collaborating with them. You know, our design team has worked with them to develop products. We have people submitting. We have people helping with retail. And so I think the way to sum up what Quirky does is social product development. You know, we want to help individuals have a meaningful interaction with the product development marketplace, which is otherwise just dominated by corporations and brands. But we get a lot of questions about how we would define Quirky, and our answer really is there aren't many companies out there that are doing something like what Quirky is doing. So we are kind of a black sheep in that respect.
Yeah, you're sort of quirky. Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Has there ever been a product that takes off so amazingly that there is a problem with the person who's thought of it not getting adequate recompense?
So do you mean a product moving so quickly that the inventor doesn't receive their royalties, or?
Do people ever regret turning over their intellectual property rights to you?
Generally no, because we're very straightforward at the beginning of the process, chatting with the inventors about what their priorities are and whether Quirky is the best option. And we also do have a proviso in our terms and conditions that says that if we've developed a product and we fully designed it and we've been pitching it to retailers, if we're not able to get it to market in 9 months, then the inventor has the ability to take that product back and try to pursue it on their own. And so we're always pushing for to get all of our inventors' products to market. But if for whatever reason we're having trouble, the inventor does have the ability to do that. So far, no inventor has taken that option. Generally, our retail team is pretty fantastic about pitching to our different retail partners, and they're constantly working on every product. But we want to be an inventor-oriented company, and so we never want to put people in a situation where that they regret working with Quirky, or where they don't have an out if it's fair and reasonable for them to have one.
Well, Baron, you're a fine spokesperson. Quirky seems like a fine idea. Certainly, all the products we've seen are very fine products. So if you need any other reason why the system works, all you have to do is look at that. So thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll have reason to talk again in the future when you've come up with some more Quirky products.
Well, we'll absolutely we'll keep working. We'll keep putting out great products. And thank you so much for having me on and talking shop.
Well, it's been fun. Thanks, Baron.
As Ann said, what a brilliant young man. And what a fascinating organization, and what great products. And we'll be right back with you after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're, of course, listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Hagen. What's up next, sweetheart?
Well, for years and years, I'm sure anybody who's read Rose Levy Berenbaum's cookbooks, baking books specifically, will understand how precise and accurate and how successful her recipes are. But I guess she noticed along the way that there were pieces of equipment and things that needed to be seriously redesigned to make them work even better and more efficiently. And she set out with a matchup with a new media, new Metro Designs. I always get that one wrong. New Metro Designs. And she's producing this extraordinary thing called the Rose Line. I'd like to go out and buy every single one of them. They're also beautiful, but also very functional. Now, we're only going to be talking about the first few, I think, and maybe hints at some others. Someday soon, when there's just a little pause in her production, we'll have to get the whole lineup of everything available through the Rose Line.
Rose Levy Berenbaum, you are the go-to person for cakes, well, for baking in general, but for cakes in particular. You wrote your iconic book, The Cake Bible, in, was it 1987? Because I know you won the your awards in 88.
That was actually written in 88.
Okay.
And it's so it makes it 21 years old now.
Uh-huh.
That's in the Stone Age, practically.
In the 80s.
But you know, the most miraculous thing is that it's in the 44th printing, which is actually the year it was born. So I think all the numbers are in perfect place.
Well, how different is this new book called Roses, Heavenly Cakes from the original Cake Bible?
It's actually entirely different, except for my what has become sort of a classic expectation, the charts, where I give the volume, the ounces in weight, and the ounces in grams, so people have the choice of all three. But what is really spectacular, literally, about this book is that the publisher was willing to put in over 100 full pages of color.
Okay.
So you can see 99% of the cakes, over 100 cakes, are photographed. So you can see inside the cake what the crumb looks like. And
you know, I wanted to ask you about that because I've noticed we get a lot of cookbooks, as you can well imagine. I've noticed this trend, instead of having this picture-perfect finished product, the trend is to show the drips, the crumbs, the smooches, the cut pieces, and you even have one photograph where there's only one slice of the cake left.
Well, this is funny because we're in the era of reality, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is often not reality. But this book really is real. I mean, everything that was done is exactly the way it actually was done. But, Anne, I did something kind of unusual here, in that after the book was published, every week, every Wednesday, I published something originally I called Outtakes, but now I'm calling Outcakes.
Oh, how cute.
Isn't it? You know, I show the pictures of the behind-the-scenes things that we couldn't fit into the book, all the step-by-step things and what might be a problem and how to solve it, and then
do you put that on your website?
Yes.
On your blog?
Yeah.
Which
really
is
fun.
The address?
It's realbakingwithrose.com.
Uh-huh.
Now, I always ask silly questions like, how did you become an expert, such an expert in making cakes in the first place?
Well, it was by default, probably, because it goes back to the fact that my mother was a dentist. She went to Pitt.
She went to Pitt?
Yeah, she was the only woman in the entire dental school.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that amazing? Dental school? How funny.
Yeah. Her mother had a candy store, and she brought me up.
Now, that was in Pittsburgh or in New York?
That was in New York.
Okay.
And what happened was, well, she never baked. I mean, she made raw candy, but my mother certainly didn't want sweets around the house. So I wasn't exposed to all these wonderful things. And then when I was about 17 and I went to college, I had my first cake that was made from scratch, and I thought the flavor was amazing, but then I had a box mixed cake that didn't taste very good, but had the softest, most tender flavor. So it became a goal to have the two together.
Well, you're an absolute perfectionist, though.
Yeah, or a compulsive maniac, you know, as it were.
But
nobody seems to mind, because when other people bake from my recipes, they get what I'm hoping for, you know, if they follow the instructions. So it kind of is forgiven that probably it was my personality problem that made me such a good baker. Uh-huh. And I guess it's not a problem if you can put it to a good use, you know.
Right.
And do you actually have a day job?
No, this is my day job.
This is your day job.
This is how I've written 9 cookbooks.
Oh, 9.
It's
my
life.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, see,
I didn't censor that one. censoring him.
And steals the books away from me, so I don't know. I heard that you wrote one 21 years ago, and I thought, boy, 21 years later, she just wrote a second book.
That makes me think of the new doctor that I went to a couple of years ago when he asked me what business I'm in, expecting a routine answer to a routine question. And I said, the pleasure-giving business. And he looked up at me and said, my husband's colleague, for one thing. You know, he's expecting something very circumspect. But isn't that the truth? I mean, giving people the enjoyment of desserts, particularly cakes, and giving them the enjoyment of being able to make them themselves is the pleasure-giving business, right?
I guess. Now, you eat all of these cakes? I mean, you're really tiny.
Well, I eat a piece of them, but this is why if I have a leak in the apartment or any kind of problem, I don't have to wait very long for the repair people, and not just one comes, but usually three, sniffing the air, you know.
Well, I tell you what, when those Verizon guys come back, the ones who were banging just before we came on the air, when they come back and they're ready to fit out your house, be sure to offer them cake. I'm sure they'll find all kinds of ways to make sure that you get the very best connections and the very best programming.
I'll take that to heart. As a matter of fact, I once offered a UPS guy a piece of cake, or cookie it was, and he said no, and I thought, wow, does he know what he's turning down? The poor guy. You know, maybe he's allergic. Who knows?
Oh.
But most of them do not say no.
Yeah, I imagine that. Yeah. Cookies, brownies.
Is this one of these things where you ask someone how they get to Carnegie Hall, and the answer is practice, practice, practice?
Well, I graduated from Carnegie Hall.
Oh, you did? Oh, my goodness.
As a matter of fact, you know, I went to Music and Art High School. That's the school part of performing arts.
One of my former best friends went there, yes.
Really? Maybe we were in the same year? Yeah. There are a lot of coincidences like that. At any rate, our graduation was held
in Ruth Reichel and I went to the same graduate school, University of Michigan, studying art history.
Oh, my stepdaughter went to U of M studying architecture.
Oh, wow.
And they're making cakes, too, right? they're slinging hash, or they're asking, would you like fries with that, sir?
People often don't go into the profession that they studied. About it totally indirectly. And I eventually went back to school, and I got my master's in food. But I never learned about cakes. I never learned about the science of baking or any of that. I sort of learned that on my own.
So it really is, in your case, it really is practice, practice, practice.
Yeah, really. My husband called me an alchemist for years, and I was insulted because I thought he meant, spinning straw into gold, that it wasn't a real science. But he told me, and it's taken 32 years to find out what he really meant, that the real scientists are the alchemists. They're the ones who actually do the applied thing. They actually bake the cake. They don't just theorize. And theories come and go, but when you see before your eyes what happens when you change an ingredient, when you use the wrong kind of flour, for example, like unbleached is not good for cakes, and the cakes will fall in the center after they come out, that's better than reading in a book somewhere something about what bleaching flour does,
Well, you have this very useful page, a section called Rose's Rules of Cake Baking, which many people don't realize how many other people using recipes modify them and then are startled by the fact that they don't get the right results.
Exactly. And the thing is, I'm not a rule follower. I was always a rebel. I mean, all of the people at Music and Art were, they were considered themselves artists, and rules are written for other people. But when people write to me on the blog and say, something didn't work, I did such and such. Like just yesterday, somebody wrote, I know the standard pan is 9x2, but I used one a little higher at 9x3. That's not a little higher.
I know.
1.5 times. And then she wanted to know why the cake cracked at the top, why it was dry. And the thing is, you can break the rules when you know what they are. When you try it the way they were supposed to be, if you change something, you can see if you like it better or if you don't like it.
Jazina Bullock, Sarah Bullock's sister.
Sandra Bullock's sister.
Yeah, Sandra. She talks about some man who was complaining about the yield, and it turns out he was eating the cookie dough.
Yeah, so he said a recipe that was supposed to make 36 only made 24 for him.
I think that people who go on blogs should have to sign a full disclosure clause first. I'm telling you what I did before I tell you why it didn't work.
Well, she did get it resolved, and her advice to simply make enough dough to make 48. Now, do you come up with all the recipes, or do you borrow them from other people? I mean, there's a whole lot of different cakes here.
That's a very good question, and people are constantly sending me recipes, so there are not that many that get sent that get used in the form that they originally are. It's a very rare thing when somebody can send a recipe and say, here, you'll love this. But usually they send it saying, I love this, but it needs work.
Oh, okay. And you do the work.
Yeah, so I really cherish them because these are recipes I might never have known about, and I'm already writing my next book because people have responded from as far away as Melbourne, Australia, that they have a great cake that I'd never heard of before. When I was on tour in Montreal, I heard about the Queen Elizabeth cake I'd never heard of. I don't know if I'm going to like it or not, but sometimes when I don't like something, there's enough about it that is original that's worth tweaking, so to speak.
Well, who would ever know there's so many possibilities for cakes? I mean, they're just endless here.
There's just so few ingredients, and that yet you can just...
But you have a new section. You never dealt with the oil cakes before,
right?
Did you?
Except for chiffon, because chiffon is an American cake that's kind of... it was invented by Harry Baker, and he was an insurance salesman from Los Angeles. And that's a cake made with oil, but I'm really talking about, I know you're talking about the layer cakes, the ones that normally are made with butter.
I mean, I know Gina De Palma, that was one of her specialties, the olive oil cakes.
See, I've never liked olive oil cakes because I don't want the taste of olive oil with sugar. I like it with savory. Although I have to say, she's one of my favorite pastry chefs.
She's such a
sweetheart. And her goat cheesecake is the best cheesecake I've ever had.
Goat cheese? That sounds really great.
Mm, but it isn't goaty tasting is the thing. I mean, it's possible to mix the savory with the sweet. For example, to have salt with caramel, it can bring out the flavor. But I don't happen to like something as strong as olive oil or even lard. I love lard and pie crusts, but I don't like them with an apple pie. I like it with savory pie or quiche.
Really? Because, I mean, yeah, the big hot thing is reverting to lard again in pies, yeah.
It's health. Well, see, that's why you can't believe any of these theories. You just have to do things in moderation. And I think that the less processing that food goes through, the better off it is, and I think the world's coming around to that same realization.
You talk also about how your new perspective is the less is more, the simpler the decorating, the better it is.
Yes, and this is another thing that's different from this book. See, the Cake Bible had a lot of decorative cakes to show people how to decorate, a lot of different elements that you could choose from, and it's really a Bible because it's my reference book. It has all the basic types of cakes. But with this book, you don't have to jump all around to put things together. Each recipe is whole in itself. And I find I wasn't trying to do it. I was discovering that I like simpler cakes. I like cakes that don't need frosting because they're moist enough and flavorful enough that you don't need to adorn them with anything. Especially if you bake them in a tube pan that has fluting, it can be so beautiful to look at, you don't want to cover it.
Yeah, those pans are amazing, aren't they?
It's really changed
was it a pine cone cake you have in here that I thought was so beautiful?
Oh, that doesn't need a cake. That doesn't even need a pan.
No, it's just gorgeous.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
See, that's one of my outcakes because we just showed part of it, like one third of the finished cake in the process of making those quills with a chocolate fondant.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it'd be fun to see the entire thing. So that's what I put up last week.
Now here's an intriguing one, a Catalan salt pinch cake.
Yeah, I got that when I was in Barcelona. It was from one of the famous cooking schools there in Girona, which is where that famous chef, El Bulli, the foam.
Right.
He's actually in Roses. He's a little bit away from Girona, but it's close by.
Right.
Right.
I heard a harrowing trip on the side of a cliff or something.
Yes,
like that.
It is indeed.
That's the one.
Yeah, I just read they're opening a molecular gastronomy cooking school in Barcelona.
Yeah, I read that too. And you know, my book is supposed to be published. The Cake Bible is supposed to be published in Barcelona. They actually got the rights to it. And luckily, the flour in Spain works the way ours does. In France and in England, you have to go through actually heat treating it or bleaching it.
Really?
Unless you're in industry. Yeah, because it's so important to have the bleached flour for most of the cakes. Not for cakes that are sponge-type cakes, but for any of the layer cakes that have either oil or butter, it really makes a big difference, and the flavor is a lot better as well. But, you know, I made an amazing discovery 2 weeks ago when I was making my stepdaughter's birthday cake. My favorite cake in the new book is golden lemon almond cake.
Oh, that sounded good, yeah.
It's my favorite non-chocolate one, so I hope that's the first one that you'll make. And I was making hamburger buns, and of course for bread you want unbleached flour because you need it to be stronger and have a little bit of chew to it. And I didn't notice, because the bags looked so similar, that I'd used it in the cake. You know, I'd gone to all the trouble of doing everything perfectly and then it was in the oven with the wrong flour.
Oh,
first of all, it browned more quickly because bleaching lowers the protein. It destroys some of the protein. So unbleached flour has a higher protein, and higher protein browns faster. But that was okay. I just thought, now it's going to fall in the center. And then I realized, in a kind of eureka moment, it doesn't have a center. It's in a tube pan, so it can't fall. So then I had my recipe tester in Minnesota try it side by side, and he said, yes, as long as you use a tube pan, it's fine. But the flavor, it's not quite as tender, of course. And it also doesn't have quite as good a flavor. But if people can only get unbleached flour, the solution is the tube pan. So you see, one keeps learning, and these little things make a huge difference.
How did you get this recipe tester where is it?
In Minnesota?
Yeah.
Cities?
It's a little, I didn't understand quite how you two connected.
Well, it was through the internet. And I did write about him in the book because
he made
such a major contribution. But
husband isn't jealous of him even.
No, because he sees what a great adjunct he's been to my work. Like, I've been working alone, and poor Elliot would come home, and I'd have to say, could you please taste this or smell this? Or, you know. And now I have somebody who's retested and tested umpteenth time every recipe in the book, and it wouldn't have worked long distance before the technology became what it is. But we both have the same digital camera, and he can even send me a motion picture of the texture.
Oh, isn't that amazing? Absolutely amazing.
There's so much to talk about with this book.
It's just
gorgeous.
Well, what I thought it would be a good idea to have Rose do is to help our listeners understand how the book's organized. because if you've got more than 100 cakes, I mean, how are you going to find the right one for the occasion or the right one with a particular ingredient? Is the book organized so that people can use it like that?
You know, this has the best index of, and the biggest one of any book that I've ever done. And I'm so glad that it makes it very easy when you're looking by ingredient. And it's interesting because in the past, when I would organize the book, my editor would always reorganize. She'd say, no, this really belongs better here or there. But this time, not a single thing was changed, and I guess it's logical. You know, there's the butter and oil cake section, and then there's the sponge cake section. Then there's the one that's mostly flourless. I say mostly because, for example, tiramisu is one of the great cakes, but it does have ladyfingers. And the filling, which is the best part, could be served over figs, fresh figs. Or you could use ladyfingers that don't have flour in them. They do make alternate ones for people who don't want to have flour or can't. So there's that chapter of mostly flourless. Then there's the baby cake chapter with all the cupcakes and the little...
Yeah, when are we going to get past cupcakes? Do you have any idea? Probably never, right?
What's this one here you have it open at? It looks like pretzels on end.
Oh, that you'll love that because that is the wedding cake chapter. And there are two special things in it. One is that this is my new chocolate chiffon type of cake that is so incredible that I have it as a baby cake, as a cupcake, as a regular cake, and I mean regular size one, the base of the German chocolate cake, and also for a wedding cake. And that wedding cake that has chocolate twigs on it.
That's the one I call pretzels.
On the milk glass plate that belonged to my mother.
Oh,
the little scallops were where the dental instruments would hang off. And when she retired, she said, maybe someday you can use it for a cake. When the prop stylist came to my house, he didn't know any of this. He looked at it and he said, that will be great for the chocolate cake. So you can imagine that incredible shiny glaze. Your listeners who aren't looking at it can see it against that milk glass, and then the black background is just stunning. And then one of the most exciting new concepts in the book, in the wedding cake chapter, is the groom's cake.
Oh, yes.
I baked a brownie into a chocolate cake. So it looks like a mosaic. You have all those gooey pockets of brownie with walnuts, or you can leave out the walnuts. But the interesting thing is that nuts don't suspend in a cake. They usually drop to the bottom.
Right.
But when you make a brownie and then break it up and fold it into the batter, it stays where you put it. So you get the nuts suspended and the pockets of, my mouth's watering, of gooey chocolate in with a tender cake. Oh, and it's baked in the stadium pan. Because I was thinking that the right-sized pan...
You know, who did that? Somebody designed that, huh?
I designed it for Nordic Ware because I said, you know, you have a wonderful daisy cake pan that is easy to serve. It's a rectangle. But I don't think most guys would appreciate having that as their groom's cake. So why don't you do something, like, related to football? And they did. Isn't that marvelous?
Oh, it's great, yeah.
And then you can spray it from a little atomizer with Maker's Mark.
Bourbon.
That sounds like a wonderful idea.
It's worth getting married for that cake. It's worth making the cake, even if you're not getting married.
Well, I mean, I can't rave enough about this book. It's just, it's beautiful. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. It's thorough. It's no fail, I think.
Thanks. I hope so, Anne. You know, of all my books, it's certainly the most beautiful. It's even stitched so it can never fall apart. And the cover happens to be one of the top 10 of all books, not just cookbooks, on Amazon. And if you vote for it by December 17th, I'm hoping it will be the winner, which would be really amazing. It's the only cookbook cover that's in the final judging.
Oh, I didn't even know they did that.
Yeah, I remember seeing how well it scored when I was putting it on our website, because the Amazon ranking comes up when you go to Amazon to get the information. So
it's like the stock market. I mean, I can't stay away. Every hour it changes, and every hour I look. It was 8 at one point, and then I told my father, who's 95, and he just couldn't understand why being a lower number is better. You know, but then right now I think it's 55. It jumps all over the place. I have to stop looking.
Well, as a final thought, let's do this. Out of all the cakes in the book, you're now about to have a cup of tea after your lunch. What cake are you going to serve yourself?
It happens to be that golden lemon almond cake, which is my favorite non-chocolate cake in the book,
right,
also goes perfectly with tea.
Uh-huh.
Not to say a chocolate cake wouldn't, because chocolate and tea can be wonderful, but lemon and tea, you know, lemon and almonds, yeah, that's what I would do.
Well,
or the whipped cream cake.
Rose, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today.
Thanks, rush out and get this one.
Yeah, you set a new standard in cakes. And I think that the 10th book is going to be on its way very soon. So I'm sure we'll talk to you again when that comes out.
I hope so. Thank you, Peter. Thank
you, Rose, Anne. It's just beautiful,
really,
and good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
A quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to move you now from Barenboim to Ray Burnhamoff, and who she and her husband Noah run this wonderful place in Brooklyn, New York, called the Mile End Deli, and you'll find out why it's called the Mile End Deli.
And they also, and we didn't mention this until partway in the interview, they also have a sandwich shop in NoHo in Manhattan.
Right.
So you got two chances to see them.
Yeah, and this wonderful cookbook, which is not as traditional as it's a step up for the whole line of cookbooks.
It's really funny. Apparently, if I'm understanding it correctly, the recipes are, if you like, Noah and Ray invented the recipes based on what they remembered of the Jewish foods of their childhood, and they,
which encompasses also Canada as well.
Because they grew up in Montreal. Who knew that?
Well, he did. She grew up in New York.
Okay, but they lived in Montreal.
Yeah, they both did.
And who knew that Montreal was a great capital for what they call smoked meat?
Smoked meat. You love that idea. I know you love smoked
meat. Well, smoked meat is great, but yeah. I didn't realize when they said smoked meat, smoked meat really means smoked brisket, I guess. They don't call it that. Why they don't call it that, I don't know. Yeah. It's just something those Montrealers
do. But the recipes are really delightful. Their take on things. So they're not just recreating. They're reinventing.
No. So,
reconceiving, reimagining.
Yeah. So listen to what.
And everybody loves the shop, the cafe.
Do they?
The deli.
Everybody
the deli.
Loves it.
Yes.
Yeah, we haven't been there yet, but I'm sure we'll love it.
Yeah, we're invited, so we're going to go.
are we going to have these people on the program?
Yes,
right now. Great, right now.
I can't tell you how I was drooling on your book, Ray Burnhamoff, the Mile End Cookbook, named after, of course, your deli, which is in Brooklyn. Where specifically in Brooklyn is it?
So we're in Borham Hill, which is very close to downtown Brooklyn and not far from the Brooklyn Bridge. We actually often have people that make an afternoon of visiting the deli, and they'll walk over the bridge and then walk about 20 minutes down Brooklyn Bridge Boulevard over to Atlantic Avenue, where our shop is located.
And then after eating a lot, they'll probably walk back again, too. Huh?
Yeah, right. that's the hope. That's the best way to do it.
So you have both the deli and a shop.
That's right. We opened our sandwich shop in NoHo on Bond between Barry and Lafayette in May, so only about 4 months ago.
All right. And you also sell products online, right?
That's right. Yeah, we actually just launched our new website last week where we built in a new e-commerce portal. So at the moment, we're selling the cookbook and some of our T-shirts and hats, and very soon we're going to add our bakery products and our meats, like our smoked meat and our hot dogs and some of our other delicatessen specialties
as well.
Okay,
and that website is?
That's mileanddeli.com.
Okay, and is there two E's right next to one another?
And two
That's
D's.
Right.
And two D's. Yeah, but okay. Let's just jump into this. I mean, I told you I was drooling when reading it. The photographs are really wicked. They really suck you in, don't they?
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was actually one of the highlights of the whole book creation process for me, was the few days that we spent taking all the photos. It was so much fun to work with a prop stylist and sort of have the deli turn into this, like, incredible housewares collection that's pulled from flea market finds and places like ABC Carpet and Home in the city. It was just so much fun to, like, create these little stories with the plateware and the textiles and all the cutlery and things of that sort.
Well, you give a lot of your history in this cookbook. A lot of the reason you're involved in this whole project is because of family, right?
That is right. Yeah, both my husband and myself have no background in the industry. This sort of all began as a small experiment, and so it's very much our families and our shared history and our love of the Jewish culture and tradition that inspired both the restaurant and the book project.
Now, the book is called Redefining Jewish Comfort Food, from hash to, what is it, hamatashen?
That's right.
The redefining is sort of an important part in there. You've modernized it in some ways, and yet in other ways, you're very traditional, like in your secret ingredient throughout all your cooking is schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat, right?
That's right, yep. Our favorite ingredient. That's why I say schmaltz is sort of like the olive oil of Jewish culture. It's our fundamental fat. It's the thing that's the basis for many of the dishes, including matzo balls, and we even use it in place of butter to toast our challah bread when we make our chicken salad sandwich. So there are a lot of applications for the schmaltz throughout the book.
Yeah, you said you use it in place of oil with your vinaigrette.
Exactly, yep.
Wow. I've never done that.
Why is it so? Why is chicken fat so central to Jewish? I mean, I never asked anybody this question before. I know it exists. Do you have any reason why in particular?
As far as I understand it, it is born from the kosher dietary restriction, so that you don't mix meat and milk when you're cooking in a kosher kitchen, and therefore you needed a fat that was meat-friendly, that wasn't going to introduce a dairy element to any dishes that you would be serving alongside
any meat products.
Okay.
That makes sense.
That started to make a little more sense.
But it's also a case of using up everything.
It's really making the most of the chicken that you have, and of course, much of this food culture was born in the shtetls of Eastern Europe, where it was all about trying to make the most of the products that you had on hand.
Now, you and your partner and husband, Noah, each do a bit of an introduction telling your story and how all this came about. And then the book is so logically, you could almost tell that your husband went to law school because it's so logically organized. You have the part one is called Do It Yourself, where you tell me, what is the do-it-yourself part?
So the first half of the book is the do-it-yourself delicatessen, which is the fundamental building blocks of deli staples like the smoked meat or the lox or the salami or any of the ingredients that you would generally find as the highlights on a deli menu. So when we started thinking about the book, we recognized that some of these recipes are definitely more advanced, right? Even though Noah's grandmother very much inspired most of the recipes and a lot of the work in the book, she was not one to smoke a brisket on her rooftop. So we recognized that although she might be interested in going to the deli and buying some smoked meat or pastrami and cooking up a hash for breakfast, she might not have had access to the equipment or interest in the process of doing the whole smoking element from start to finish. So we decided to create the first half that included these building blocks and then position the second half to the table with all of the ready-to-eat, ready-to-prepare dishes so that you can have the recipe for the smoked meat hash without necessarily making the smoked meat from the first half. Or you have the recipe for the mishmash, which is a very simple egg scramble dish, which you can include either salami or lox from the first half, or you can go to the store and purchase those products yourself.
Yeah, I would be inclined to contact your website.
At the moment, we don't yet have any of the food products on offer, but within the next few weeks, they'll all be up there. So I definitely encourage you to check that out. And again, I think we organize it in such a way that we hope that if you start with some of the products that you might regularly buy in the grocery or at your delicatessen counter, you then recognize that perhaps you might take it on as a weekend project to make the lox or make some of the other fundamental building blocks. And that also includes all of our pickled vegetables, which are really simple to prepare. It's really more about planning in advance and giving yourself the time to let it cure.
Yeah, and you also interweave, I don't know what you'd call these little essays, by various experts, including, I'm looking at, and we've interviewed Bob McClure about his pickles, and they're very good pickles.
Oh, is he the guy from Seattle?
Detroit.
Detroit, okay. I'm mixing him up with somebody else.
And he's based now in Brooklyn, so his brother's in Detroit, and he's in Brooklyn, and he's a good friend of ours. So we weaved, we're calling them different Maven essays, so people that we consider
Maven
to be experts
essays
in their field.
It's and a nice Jewish word right there, Maven.
Yeah. Exactly. So we weave their stories throughout because these are people that have influenced us and our practice and our approach to food, and they're also people that have really important stories to tell themselves, and they're all friends of ours, and we figured it was a way to enrich the content in the book to bring their perspectives to the table as well.
And it is. It's a hugely enriching book. I just love it. And you have some really unusual, you instead of the typical Jewish deli tongue sandwich, you use lamb's tongue.
That's right. Noah, my husband, likes to call it nature's hot dog.
Nature's hot dog.
Because they're not as large and unwieldy as a beef tongue. There are these small little tongues that actually look like hot dogs and almost have a very similar texture to hot dogs as well.
Well, now, where do you, because we have friends who have an organic lamb farm near us. Where do you get the quantity you need? Because Mario Batali went to them and wanted, I forget how many thousands, lamb tongues a week. and they had to kind of remind him that you only get one tongue per lamb.
Right. We have a great meat packer that we use here, and I'm sure we don't have the need for the same quantity that Mario Batali does. But for those that are going out to butcher shops in their neighborhoods, it's definitely something that you might want to call in advance to reserve.
And then you have lamb bacon.
Yeah, there were a lot of instances throughout in the book where we tried to come up with alternatives to use pork so that although our delicatessen isn't kosher, we very much respect the tradition and made an effort in the book to not include any recipes that mix meat and milk. So in place of a pork bacon, we came up with a lamb bacon, which has a lot of great applications, including as a substitute for making baked beans.
What, like, looking over this, it's a hard question. What do you think are some of the highlights that you include in this book that you don't find in ordinary cookbooks, especially ordinary Jewish cookbooks? I was saying, like, pickled fennel. When do you find that in a Jewish cookbook?
Right. Yeah, I would definitely say, you know, the first half of the book, the DIY delicatessen, is unique amongst Jewish cookbooks because it's not necessarily the practice that you find in your grandmother's kitchen. The staples, the holiday classics like the braised brisket and the chicken soup and the simis are dishes that appear in most Jewish cookbooks. We hope that we've offered a new perspective on them and maybe presented an alternative technique to preparing them, but definitely the first half of the book does offer a lot of the more process-driven recipes that are unique, I think, to our restaurant in Brooklyn and to this cookbook.
Yeah, you even have now preserved lemons, which have become really popular lately. But I imagine that's not unusual if, in fact, you were a Jew living in the Middle East.
Exactly, and all the pickle recipes as well. I mean, these are sort of our approach to food at the deli is to really go back to the way it was being made 100 years ago. So we're avoiding or bypassing the conveniences that became popular mid-century and the shortcuts that became part of the everyday approach to food and going back to the way perhaps our ancestors in the shtetl may have made their food, which is to really work with produce that's available seasonally, pickle it to preserve it throughout the year, and utilize cuts of meat that were plentiful in that region, which, of course, are the brisket and chicken dishes and things of that sort.
So tell me what other of your dishes are the most popular.
Most popular? Well, of course there's the smoked meat. That's the house specialty, and that's sort of the thing that most everyone knows us for. It wasn't necessarily how we conceived of the deli, and it wasn't necessarily the food stuff that we thought was really going to define what we do, but somehow over time I think that classic deli meat has really become our most popular offering. And again, smoked meat is like the Canadian cousin of pastrami, so it's a cured and smoked beef brisket sandwich that we serve on a house-baked rye. So that's definitely, in our restaurant, the most popular, and I do hope that the recipe here will be utilized by a lot of our readers. When my husband Noah developed the recipe, he actually had no professional experience in the kitchen, nor did he have any experience smoking anything ever. He had just bought a bullet smoker and as a hobby started just trying out different recipes on our rooftop, and he realized that after trolling the internet for hours on end, he couldn't really find any recipes for smoked meat. So he really based the fundamentals on his memories of eating this cured and smoked beef brisket and then tweaked it from there. So there were many briskets that were, you know, prepared over time that didn't have the right balance of spices, and we're excited now to be able to present this recipe and offer it up to anyone who's interested in trying it out.
Now, you go above and beyond a little bit in another direction too, and just opened a book at the section Matches Made in Heaven, which is of course how to pair wines with your food.
And they do craft beers too.
And they do beers too?
craft beers.
Okay, but that's interesting and something you don't see in a lot of delicatessens.
That's right, yeah. The restaurant is very much a reflection of our interests, of course. It's a tiny little spot in Brooklyn. We only have 25 seats, and we opened up as an experiment. Again, we didn't have any experience in the industry, and we figured we might as well just try it out and see if we can make it work. So because we love wine and we love craft beer, we put together a list that reflected that interest. And in the book, we have one of our maven spreads is a good friend of ours, Nick Domino, who owns a local wine shop, and he offers suggestions for approaching pairing and thinking about how to choose a wine for your holiday table. And that was something that we were excited to include because it isn't necessarily the focus of most Jewish cookbooks.
No, I had a mission once.
Oh, I was just going to tell that story.
we went to Seder, a friend of Anne's, and long old friend of Anne's in New York, decided to do traditional Seder. For some reason, we couldn't understand, but we got to go. Eat from Pittsburgh to have this meal.
Wow, my best friend.
And then my job was to go out and buy a wine that would go with the Seder meal with absolutely no idea pairing might be. So I found a wine shop that actually would admit to having wines made by Manischewitz. And one was Cream White Concord, which at the time the spokesperson was Sammy Davis Jr. I don't know if you remember that far back. And I didn't like that idea. And the other choice was Kosher Sangria.
It was just ghastly.
That came in a very large bottle, so it looked like a deal.
Right.
It was quite a deal. It was really quite awful.
It was the worst thing anybody had ever drunk.
But we were very kosher.
Yeah. Oh, and well. You have to have a lot of glasses at the Seder, too.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I just think you'd be somebody I'd really like to meet, so next time we make our pilgrimage to Brooklyn, I want to make that happen.
And please do. I'd love to meet you guys.
Yeah, and I would like to eat almost all this stuff. I'm looking at this, the kosher corned beef sandwich. I mean, it's just fabulous looking. Pickled eggs. Everything about it is just wonderful. And I'm glad that you're successful. I understand that when you started this, you were going to have a stand-up only restaurant. You figured out that would work?
So when we opened the sandwich shop in NoHo, the concept was to have a central communal table that was standing room only so that we avoided the issue that we often face in Brooklyn, which is only having 25 seats and having not enough space for our guests. So we figured if we had a large table which everyone could stand around, you would always be able to find a spot. Unfortunately, it wasn't as well received as we had intended, so we have added stools and now do offer the same communal table experience but with seating.
Well, I wish you continued success, and you certainly have been well received by all variety of media, and I don't know why not, because it's just wonderful. Ray,
thank you. So much.
Yeah, I really thank you for talking to us, and I hope to enjoy this book.
Yeah, and say hi to Noah. We understand that he's busy cooking or serving or something is going
on. Exactly. Well, the Jewish holidays are starting on Sunday,
yes.
So we're knee-deep in brisket over here.
I'm knee-deep in brisket. I love it.
Well, once again, Ray.
And swimming in schmaltz.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much for being with us today on The Menu. And that's all from us at On The Menu for another week. We'll see you again, same time, same place next week, we hope.
Bye-bye.